Today I'll be talking about, this is sort of maturing research in support of my PhD thesis. It's titled Making Problem Diagnosis Work for Large-Scale Production Storage Systems, and it's work that I've done with my advisor, Carnegie Mellon, as well as Kevin Harms in the Argonne Leadership Computing Facility at Argonne National Laboratory. So a few years ago, we became interested in problem diagnosis as a research space. And sort of at a very top-level perspective, we're interested in problem diagnosis because clustered systems and more generally computer systems, we know that they experience a variety of problems. And a familiar class of problems to most folks are outright crashes, where you have a system that's operating, is doing jobs, and then suddenly something happens and the system is no longer operating. And this is something that's very visible to users, to operators, and to everybody. But there's also a different class of problems called performance problems. And here, you have a system where everything is operating correctly. Jobs are still being fulfilled, things are still getting done, but they're not getting done to the same level of performance that folks expect. And there's a lot of underlying reasons for performance problems, but an interesting reason for performance problems is when you have failures of hardware components that reduce availability and things like that. So traditionally, problem diagnosis is performed manually. This is especially the case in the class of systems I've been looking at, which is HPC storage systems. And the problem here is that as these systems grow and get larger, they become burdened by their many components, their many failure modes. In short, it's complicated and costly to do this sort of manual diagnosis. And there's been a lot of research effort in the past decade to try to automate problem diagnosis. And this is an effort to try to automate problem diagnosis, again, in the research space of HPC storage systems. So the goal of this work is to make problem diagnosis work on a very large production storage system. And in particular, we're targeting the primary storage system of the Intrepid supercomputer. So a lot of HPC storage systems are based on parallel file systems. And the research here is kind of interesting when you try to do problem diagnosis in it. And the reason is that the parallel file system is engineered in such a way that balancing workloads across all components in the storage system is a high-level design ideal. So the idea here is that if you have, by design, a system that takes essentially any workload and tries to balance it across all the components, then we expect that all the components in the system should exhibit similar behavior. So wherever we see an imbalance of performance among components in parallel file systems, this is often an acute sign of a problem, so like some components actually failing on us. But even where it may not necessarily indicate an acute problem, it still identifies an area for performance improvement. And so if we can take that one area of the system that's underperforming and we improve it, we actually improve the overall performance of the system. When we first started doing this research, one of the things that we looked at was, you know, how often do we see performance imbalances in these systems? And roughly 2% of any storage unit in Intrepid is actually out of balance with respect to other components of the system at any given time. And if you look at these, often these are legitimate problems in terms of we'll look at logging, we'll see I/O timeouts, we'll see media errors. But other times, you don't necessarily know why this is happening, at least by looking at our first order mechanisms like storage controller logs. These problems often start out intermittently, but then they'll increase in frequency. The agents responsible for maintaining these systems, for example, storage controllers, are supposed to fail these components automatically, but they won't necessarily do so because they don't have this overall viewpoint of the entire system, and they don't necessarily know how any one component influences the overall performance. In short, existing tools have incomplete coverage. So the approach that we've been using for problem diagnosis is a black box-based approach. And the idea here is we analyze operating system-level performance metrics in order to tell you when you have a problem in the system. Now here, we do not do code-level instrumentation. We don't have to modify the file system. We don't have to modify an RPC layer. All we're doing is installing additional software that just collects performance metrics that are already made available by the operating system. The other thing about this method is that it's low overhead. The data collection, it's finite data size, it's well-known payload sizes, And we also know basically what the upper bounds are in terms of the impact on performance of the instrumentation itself. So it's actually production friendly. We can take the stuff, we can put it on a production system, and the operators who run that system will actually feel comfortable doing 24/7 instrumentation because they don't have concerns about will the instrumentation itself actually adverse the performance of their system. And finally, we also make few assumptions about workload, which is good because we don't necessarily know what workloads are going to be running ahead of time, and we won't necessarily be able to characterize them. So this approach also intends to serve as a tool for triaging problems. And sort of the spectrum here is limping but alive performance problems, where the system is basically severely degraded in terms of its ability to perform, and we want to know why. But the other end of that is when there may be a problem in the system that we can tell from performance metrics, but from a user visible perspective, they may not even be aware that something's going on. This is still important, though, because here typically we'll see that we have hardware failures that reduce the redundancy of the system, and where there's a reduction in redundancy, eventually that will contribute to a reduction in availability if these problems are not quickly addressed. Finally, this approach is intended to provide a sort of catch-all or holistic solution to monitoring. It's not intended to replace component-specific monitoring. It's intended to supplement it. And the reason for this is this mechanism provides a whole picture view of the system and its interactions, whereas component-specific monitoring can only give you sort of perspective on one corner of the system. And really using those two in tandem will actually help you figure out, you know, when you have a problem, how much does it actually affect the entire system, but then also, you know, you have greater details on how to go find those problems, isolate them, and fix them. So this is sort of just a simple plot that I want to use to sort of motivate our approach. For this problem diagnosis, we use a technique called peer comparison. And so this is a plot of disk throughput for 10 storage devices in a very small parallel file system cluster. And for this 10 minutes that we're running a workload, 9 of the 10 storage units have such tightly coupled throughput that they're all superimposed on that blue line on the bottom. But 2 minutes into this workload, we actually inject a fault into the system that actually causes one of the storage units to see a much greater increased throughput relative to everybody else. And the idea of peer comparison is we try to find where metrics we expect to be consistent across components actually deviate, and then to locate those deviations and to tell operators that these are the components you should go look at. So at FAST 2010, I presented a paper that basically took that peer comparison approach and ran it in a set of what I call lab experiments. They were small 10 to 12 server PBFS and Lustre clusters. The workloads were synthetic file system benchmarks. The faults we injected, they were supposed to model generic performance issues. And we got interesting results, and people said, you know, this looks really good. You should continue this work. So where we went with it is we took this technique and we applied it to black box problem diagnosis and GPFS. This is, and specifically, we looked at the Intrepid storage system. It's a 9,000 component production environment. We were able to improve our diagnosis algorithm over our previous effort, and we were also able to address the challenges of diagnosis at scale. So what I'm presenting here is actually going to be a 15-month case study of problems in the Intrepid storage system and our ability to use our technique to localize a variety of problems across the storage stack, and to do so at latencies comparable to the existing approaches used by operators, and we were even able to identify problems that operators missed. So for the rest of the talk, I'll give a brief background on GPFS and how parallel file systems work. I'll talk about a diagnosis approach, and then I'll go into the case study evaluation. So IBM's general parallel file system is a clustering parallel file system designed to support I/O and metadata intensive applications. It provides high bandwidth, concurrent access to files, and the design of it is at a high level similar to PBFS, Lustre, GlusterFS, or other sort of file systems if you're familiar with them. Down here I sort of describe in text what the components are of a GPFS cluster, but it's easier to show visually. So at the high level you have a bunch of GPFS clients. Each client makes requests across a local area network to each file server. The file servers themselves have attachments, typically either InfiniBand or fiber channel attachments, to storage controllers. These storage controllers export disk arrays, which then the file servers can see. Now, if you dig into a parallel file system, what makes them really interesting is their data striping model. So if you have a single workload, a single writer, and you have it writing sequentially to a logical file in the file system, the file system itself will actually take that sequential workload and stripe it into blocks between 16 kilobytes to 4 megabytes in size. And it takes each one of these chunks and it writes it round robin to every storage unit, to every storage controller, to every file server in the system in round robin order. So the idea here is that you can have a single workload doing this sort of sequential activity, and yet the file system enforces this condition where that workload will actually be balanced across all the components. So here we derive this hypothesis that that components in the system that have similar function should exhibit similar performance, and we can observe this in performance metrics. If we have a fault in the system or a faulty component, it should exhibit asymmetries in at least certain metrics. And if we use peer comparison to figure out which metrics are different across these components, we should be able to identify which components in the system are faulty. Now, as we move up into Intrepid, there's a number of challenges that we were trying to address. For one, it's a large-scale multi-tier system. We observe problems manifesting at every level of the storage stack. It's an environment where we have limited control. We have heterogeneous workloads running on clients of effectively unknown behavior. We have unplanned hardware faults we're trying to find, and we're trying to do this on a continuous 24/7 basis. So the problem diagnosis approach that we use consists of four stages. The first is instrumentation, where we collect these operating system level metrics. The second stage is problem diagnosis, which itself consists of two phases. The first is anomaly detection, where we instantaneously tell you what's wrong in the system, basically for one window of time. And then the second phase is persistence ordering, where we actually then include some idea of local history, and we actually say that for this recent period of time, we've seen these anomalies in the system. And finally, we rank and order the list of suspected components, and we present them to the operators. So, as I said, instrumentation consists of sampling of operating system level performance metrics. We collect these once a second for every storage unit across every file server in the system. Because we're collecting these at the level of the file server, we're actually observing the compound effect of the file server, disk arrays, attachments, and controllers all the way underneath them. The metrics that are interesting to us are throughput in terms of bytes read and written a second, as well as latency in terms of I/O wait time. This is the amount of I/O time. This is the amount of time that an I/O request spends both being queued as well as being serviced by the underlying storage device. Now, in this work, I/O wait time alone is sufficient to diagnose most problems, so it's the metric that I'm going to focus on for the remainder of the talk. Now, the problem diagnosis phase or stage consists of two phases. There's anomaly detection, where we compare performance metrics across all the components in the system. And for one window of time, we tell you which components are anomalous for that window. The second phase is persistence ordering. And here, we maintain an accumulation of anomalies for components across a long period of time. And we actually then point out to operators which of these components have been anomalous the longest. So to dive into anomaly detection, there's a few methods that we use to do this that we present in the paper. One of them is a method in which we compare the CDF, the cumulative distribution functions, of metrics across different components. So this is an example of what a CDF looks like as approximated by a histogram. So the metric that we're interested in here is on the x-axis, it's request wait time. And the y-axis is a number of samples that we have for the wait time in a window. And so because it's cumulative, as we keep adding samples, we actually increase our bucket size until we get to the total number of samples, which we have is 60. So if we generate these histograms for all components in the system, in this case, we have a sample where there's four components, what we then do is we compute a distance between the histograms for each pair of components. So the distance is a scalar value that says how different any two pair of components in the system are from each other. It's just a number. What we then do is we walk around, and looking at every pair of components in the system, we'll flag a pair of components as being anomalous if their scalar distance value exceeds a threshold. And this is a threshold that we determine through a procedure we describe in the paper, but basically it's done automatically through stress testing. And finally, what we do is we walk around and we'll flag any component in the system as anomalous if over half of its pairs have been marked anomalous. So in this case, we have one component in the system that has a CDF histogram that's markedly different from the other three, so we mark it as anomalous. Now, this is all done for each window of time. And in one of these windows, we basically tell you which components in the system are anomalous with respect to the other ones. But to get more value out of this, we do this persistence ordering, where we actually start looking at local history. So the way that we do this is we maintain a positive value accumulator for every storage component in the system. If we look at the same four components, we'll say for time window 0, there is no accumulated anomalies. So walking through an example here, say at time window 1, the yellow component becomes anomalous, so we mark it with a value 1 in its accumulator. At time window 2, the yellow, blue, and purple components are all anomalous, so we mark the two we haven't seen before by a 1. Since the yellow component has been anomalous for two windows, we actually increase its value to 2. Now, at the third time window, the yellow component is no longer anomalous. It's actually become normal again in behavior. So we actually subtract 1 from its accumulated value for each window where it exhibits normal behavior. Since the other components are all now anomalous, we add 1 for each of those. At time window 4, the yellow component has been now normal long enough that it has returned back to a 0 state, and it will stay there. It doesn't ever go negative. The other components, they increase their anomaly values. Finally, at time window 5, we see that the blue and yellow components have been normal for a long enough time now that we consider them to no longer be anomalous. The orange and the purple components have been anomalous for quite some time. The second part of persistence ordering is once we tabulate these values, all we do is for each window of time, we just order the list of components by those that are the most anomalous. So for time window 0, there's no anomalies, so they all have the same ordering. Time window 1, the yellow component's most anomalous. At time window 2, the yellow component is still the most anomalous. At 3, the blue and the purple components now have overtaken the yellow component in its recent history of being anomalous. At time window 4, the purple component has been the most anomalous in recent history. And finally, at time window 5, it's still the most anomalous. So what we would say, if we're looking at this output, is that the purple and the orange components have been the most anomalous in recent history. So if there is a problem in the system, the operator should go investigate those components first. So that's basically the approach to our problem diagnosis. For our case study, we actually looked at applying this approach to the Intrepid storage system. This is a system that consists of 128 file servers. It's 1,152 disk arrays across 16 storage boxes or storage racks. There's 11,000 total disks, and it's a system that's used for high-performance computing workloads, mostly for checkpointing, and this is a study that we performed over 474 days. So the architecture of the Intrepid storage system is essentially the same as that high-level architecture I presented earlier. We have BlueGMP I/O nodes that they collect all the I/O operations from compute nodes and they forward them to the file system. There's 128 file servers. NSD is Network Shared Disk Server in GPFS terminology. Each of these servers has InfiniBand attachments to these 16 storage racks. The storage racks export disk arrays or LUNs. Now, looking at the storage arrays themselves, there's 16 of these racks that have two storage controllers in each rack that are coupled together and can serve for each other redundantly. Now, there are 8 servers connected to those two storage controllers in two sets of 4. So 4 file servers connected to controller A, 4 file servers connected to controller B. Now, both storage controllers are actually connected to 10 disk drawers. And so these 10 disk drawers actually form vertical RAID arrays. So they're in 8 plus 2 pairings. So the top 8 drawers are all basically data arrays, and the bottom 2 drawers are parity arrays. And the way that this works is each spindle vertically actually forms a disk array that's exported out to the clients. And then there's 72 of these disk arrays across each of the 16 storage boxes. So the method of evaluation here is we collect instrumentation data from all the file servers. What we actually did was we took our approach and we applied it to the system offline after we collected the data for 15 months. But the approach in applying it was done in the same way an operator would do it if the approach was done online. So basically, we do our time windows, we generate our list of top 100 most persistently anomalous LUNs, and then we go investigate the topmost anomalous LUN for any period of time, we investigate the topmost anomalous LUN if it had an anomaly score larger than 100, which is about half a day. And in doing so, we would actually go check the data controller logs, figure out what the problem was. We didn't know ahead of time what the problems were. We were actually discovering these as we went through the data. And if we found a problem, we would regenerate our list. So we observed a variety of problems. I described them extensively in the paper. For the interest of time, I'll go through two of these in detail here. So the first one I want to sort of mention in detail was actually a misconfiguration event. So here was an instance where in our storage controller we had a situation where on reboot the cache coherency between controller A and controller B was actually disabled, or at least failed to establish. When this happened, this effectively partitioned our sets of file servers in half, such that the odd number disk arrays in the system were only accessible by the file servers in controller A, and the even number disk arrays in the system were only accessible by controller B. So this meant that half the I/O requests in the system would fail because we would access file servers that couldn't see the appropriate disk arrays. And then the clients would have to fall back to secondary connections, which are on the other controller, and then things would succeed. This was a problem that our approach was able to diagnose in 8 hours. At the time that this problem happened, these problems were discovered and recovered within 1 to 4 days. The second interesting problem was a cascaded failure. And this was an incident where there was a storage controller in the system that was suffering from frequent I/O timeouts. And suddenly, after doing this for a while, the storage controller performed 71 LUN reset operations. This is a very heavyweight operation to basically reset the state of the system, and it would actually delay I/O responses up to nearly 2 minutes. Now, because there's so much delay in responses to I/O, three servers actually timed out, and from that point on, refused to serve any additional requests to those storage devices in the future. Meanwhile, the controller and the disk arrays recover. They actually remain in operation. This is a problem that we were able to see from our monitoring in 39 minutes, but actually went undiscovered for 50 days. And this is because these were redundant components in the system. The decrease in performance was not so sufficient that it caused a user visible problem. It caused, you know, an effort to go in and figure out exactly what was going on. It sort of escaped that level of detection. They actually had a mechanism in the system to figure out when these attachments to the file servers went down, but misimplemented the grep statement to match it from syslog, and so it escaped that monitoring as well. So the problem only ever was resolved because the affected file servers were incidentally rebooted after 50 days, and things were reestablished. So this is a problem that just sort of motivates why having a monitoring approach that looks at all components in the system and can tell you where there are things weird in certain areas of the system may be a benefit, because specific mechanisms to do monitoring may not be sufficient in order to find these sort of problems. So as I said, I had some more interesting examples in the paper, but in the interest of time, I'll conclude. So we applied black box problem diagnosis to Intrepid's production GPFS storage system. We did a 15-month case study where we witnessed a variety of problems, and we were able to diagnose some of these variety of problems at latencies that are comparable to existing approaches, and we even identified problems that the operators themselves missed. And with that, I'll take questions.
So you made one assumption that's usually not helpful, and that was that GPFS would spread the reads fairly well for you. One thing that we used to notice was that if someone had a small file like 64 megs and decided all 1,000 nodes needed to read it at once, it was always going to screw over one or two nodes. So everyone else, you basically said you were thinking about throughput, but IO8 was the real thing. Are you using that to try and remove confounding errors?
Yeah, so there's a few things here. So throughput, looking at throughput, it depends on what you consider to be a problem. If you want to know where you have throughput imbalances in the system, because that means that your capacity is misdistributed, then you can do this peer comparison on throughput itself to pull out the devices in the system that are exhibiting hotspots in terms of throughput. If your model is, well, I don't really mind at this point in time where data is distributed in the system, it may be misbalanced, that might be a function of having upgraded your system at some point in time, adding new capacity, so that at the time that you added that new capacity, most of your I/O would go to the new storage units, mm-hmm. and thus any subsequent read would all be fetched from those storage units, then you can just say, well, no, what I really only care about is when I know that throughput is consistent across a set of components in the system, a subset that is, then you can start looking at the latency within those that subset of components and then pull out any problems within there. But you can call out any sort of difference in the workload distribution because you're just saying for now you're okay with that.
Okay. And the other one was one of the nastier kind of bugs is if you've got, say, you know, one core in the box is bad and it's can't do checksums anymore, so it keeps failing them. So it keeps pulling in replicas from other machines. So you get where there's a hotspot, but it isn't caused by the user. It's caused by, you know, buggy hardware, bug in the system. Have you come across that, or can you use some sort of analysis to ignore that and say, well, that's not?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing is you'd probably be interested in knowing that problem exists. Mm. And the way that would show up right now is that any I/O activity that involves, say, that particular file server would show up as being anomalous. So you might get a list of, you know, 70 things that are all marked as anomalous, but they're all tagged by this is file server 16. Mm-hmm. And so you would look at that list and quite quickly determine, well, if the common component here is file server 16, then that's likely where the problem is. You might find there's probably some hardware issue there. You're not quite sure. You're waiting for the vendor to come out to investigate. What we actually have is a procedure where you can actually say, OK, for this type of problem or for these affected components, I want to turn down the squelch knob now. I don't want to be further alarmed that there's issues with this component because I know there's issues with it, but I'm not taking it out of service. And in response, what we'll actually do is we'll tell you then when you have problems on any other components that are not that one or when that component gets worse.
Cool. Okay.
Hi, you did this offline. Do you have any experiences with doing this online in real time?
So, I do not have direct experience doing this online in real time. What I did, though, in the paper is what I hope is a somewhat convincing analysis that this entire procedure can be done in real time using a single dedicated machine that just snarfs in this data, does the analysis, and then provides the output. I do have an interest in doing this online. It's sort of almost like a user study in some way, maybe as an operator study. Unfortunately, this system is being decommissioned next month, so it seems that opportunity is escaping me at this point in time. I can't afford to keep it running.